Dana Gioia is an internationally acclaimed award-winning poet. He is the former chairman of the National Endowment of the Arts and is their current Poet Laureate of California. He has published 5 full-length collections of poetry and 8 chapbooks. And we are here today to talk about his latest book, 99 Poems. Dana, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Well, I'm delighted to be on the show.
And congratulations, you are the new Poet Laureate of California.
It's an honor, and no one was more surprised than me.
And you're following Juan Felipe Herrera, who is very, very, very active in his role as Poet Laureate and now his current role as U.S. Poet Laureate. So what do you plan on doing as California Poet Laureate?
Well, you know, in a general sense, what I think any Poet Laureate does is to try to bring the power of poetry, the power of literature, to the broadest audience possible. But in a state like California, which is very much like Texas, which is a huge state, I mean, California is 1,000 miles from top to bottom, and most people who visit California never go more than about 50 miles inland.
Yeah.
So in a state like California, I think my challenge is to go out to all of these smaller communities that don't normally have, you know, many cultural events, many literature events. It's the communities along the border, in the desert, up in the mountains, on the North Coast. So I've set myself a goal, and it's going to be the I don't know about the death of me, but it's going to be the death of my car, you know, of trying to visit every county in California.
Oh, that's a wonderful idea. Yeah, yeah, so there are like pockets of literary communities, like in Fresno and Hayward and, you know, and Oakland. But there's a lot of communities that certainly aren't accessing poetry at all.
Yeah, you know, the invitations will naturally come from L.A., San Francisco, right, Oakland, Sacramento, you know, the big towns. You know, but the smaller towns, you know, are really going to feel hesitant in inviting you. They don't have any budget.
Right.
But the interesting thing is, I don't care how small the town is that you go to. You know, go in the public library, you meet these people. There's always a couple of other writers. There's always students, you know, who want to write. And so, you know, you're really, you know, I think one hopes to create a statewide, you know, sense of community among readers, among writers, among educators.
You know, Juan Felipe Herrera said that we need a California Poet Laureate like Dana right now, which is high praise from him. And I'm thinking about your living situation. If I'm not mistaken, you divide your time between the Los Angeles area and around Sonoma.
Well, like a lot of my grandfather and great-grandfather, I am a migrant laborer. You know, I do it on a better pay scale than my Mexican grandfather and his family. But, you know, I live half the year down in L.A. because I teach at USC in the fall.
Oh.
But, you know, I didn't want to be – I never was a teacher except on a kind of a visiting gig basis.
Right.
I was never a teacher until I was 60. And, you know, and for years I've, you know, made my living as a writer, and I didn't want to cut myself off from being an active writer. So I only teach half the year, and then the rest of the year I live out in the country up in Northern California. But, you know, curiously, that gives me an easier base to visit everywhere because I can sort of do the bottom half of the state,
right,
you know, half the year in the northern half of the state, you know, the other half of the year.
Right. So you're all over California anyway, which is a good start.
My whole life. You know, I've never been able to settle into any one thing except for writing.
So when you're in the north, you're in wine country. And I had planned to ask you to give us a little background about you before we get into your new book, 99 Poems, New and Selected. But we're kind of doing that organically anyway. And I was wondering, when you go to L.A. and then you go for part of the year to Northern California, do the various locations affect the way you write and what you write?
Well, they do. I mean, I was born in kind of a rough part of L.A. called Hawthorne.
Oh, yeah, I know Hawthorne very well. Yes.
You know, I went to high school at Sarah High on Compton Boulevard.
Oh, my gosh.
In Gardena.
Right.
And so, that L.A., you know, which I spent the first 25 years of my life, you know, one way or the other there, evokes past memories. You know, I came into Northern California sort of in middle age. My parents had moved up to about an old chicken farm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my dad, I have a very odd family. My dad was, when I was born, my dad was a Sicilian cab driver. My mom, you know, was a Mexican who worked at a phone company. None of them, neither family had ever had anybody intermarry before. So it was, it seems like an odd, but it was a big deal back then, you know. Mm. And, the Italians couldn't believe my dad was marrying a Mexican. You know, the Mexicans thought my dad was in a, must be mafia or something, right. You know. So I was had kind of mixed background there, and very rich. I had a great family. One of the pleasures of going to L.A. is I get to see my family again. You know, but it puts me in two worlds. One's very urban, and mm-hmm. one's very rural. And I like that, you know. And so it tends to kind of awaken different parts of your memory and imagination.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I used to work in Downey, California.
Yeah, I know Downey.
Yeah. I was a bartender at this club they called the Red Onion. I don't think it exists anymore.
Yeah, I've been to the Red Onion.
Yeah.
It used to be like a little chain
yeah.
in L.A. Yeah, the Red Onion.
And it was,
I hadn't even thought of the Red Onion for, God, years.
Yeah, it was a meat market. I used to have to wear these little tiny shorts behind the bar and spin the bottles and try to look all Hollywood. But
important skills for a writer to have.
Absolutely. Your last name, Gioia, means joy in Italian. And what is your Mexican name? Because if you were in Mexico, you would attach that to right after Joya.
Really weird. You know, my Mexican name is Ortiz, but one of my relatives changed it to Ortez. He thought people would think he was Spanish rather than Mexican.
Oh my God.
Because
right.
It was hard for a Mexican to get a job, but it didn't. So I got complete confusion. But my great grandfather, Jesus Ortiz, came over from Chihuahua, and he was a vaquero. And he and his kids used to ride the cattle rides, mm-hmm. Big cattle drives up in, from Montana down to Denver. And they lived on, a reservation. I think my great grandfather married an Indian. And so it was a very, kind of a very nomadic life. They were always, losing things. And finally, my great grandfather was killed he was a bartender.
Mm-hmm.
Got a job in the winter in a bartender. And I'm not making this up. In a town called Lost Cabin, Wyoming.
Oh, perfect.
He cut some, guy off, because the guy couldn't pay. Uh-huh. Guy came back an hour later and blew him away with a shotgun.
Oh, my God.
And, then his kids were kind of like, 14 and 13 were fatherless. They were, they were riding the range with him because he took them out of school to, help make a living. And so, it was a strange thing. One of them ended up down in L.A. That's my grandfather, Francisco. And, he sort of tried to, started over in L.A. He was going to get rich. I think the day he died, he was still planning to get rich.
In a lot of books of poems, you can immediately identify, whether correctly or not, the speaker of the poem with the writer. And I can't do that with your poems. Your poems are a little bit more, sometimes the speakers, they change a lot. And I would think, this is a made-up story.
No, it really is. I mean, people that meet me, they don't, they're surprised when they hear about my background.
Right.
Because, I've had to make a living in a very different world.
Right.
But yeah, I think what your observation is probably the truest thing someone can say about my poetry. In fact, I was just this morning writing a PhD candidate in Italy wants to know, which of my poems are autobiographical and not. I've written a few poems, especially about the death of my first son, that are autobiographical.
Right.
But, by and large, what I like to do is to take something that happened to me and use it as a base of a poem, then I'll take something I've heard from somebody else, and I make a story, I make a situation. And what that gives me is a certain kind of objectivity. And I think I can make the story sharper, and, this sounds ironic, I think I can make it truer.
Right.
By not making it autobiographical. About my grandfather, I'm actually trying to write about that again. I've tried to write about that in a couple of ways, and it's really weird. A bunch of cowboy poets read a story about it in Wyoming, because I went to Wyoming and I said, the last member of my family to come to Wyoming, you shot, the papers did an article about it, and the cowboy poets had turned it into a cowboy ballad. So actually, that's what I'm, God help me, that's what I'm trying to do now,
right.
Is sort of to write it in a story almost like in the tradition of Western ballads, which is not inappropriate, because, my grandfather used to sit around these campfires, and he said, and they would recite poems and sing songs. And so I'm trying to write a poem that he could have read aloud about his father.
Right.
And I don't know if I'm going to be able to do it, but that's what I'm trying to do now. Because I keep every time I write about it, I fail and I throw the poem away.
You throw it in the metaphorical campfire.
Exactly. I fail a lot as a writer. I mean, it's
It's nice to hear you say that, because not everything you do can be perfect.
No, it isn't. And, you know, even the things one publishes are, you know, well, you know, when you're writing a poem, you think it's the greatest thing ever written.
Right.
You know, and then a week later when you start to revise it, you realize it's not as good as you remember, you know. And then sometimes it just keeps getting worse. When you're lucky, it keeps getting better.
Yeah, you know, when I'm a fiction writer, and when I first started writing fiction, I would write a story, think it was brilliant, and send it, okay, this has got to go to the New Yorker. And then a couple of months later, I'd look at it and say, oh, this is really crap. So,
yeah.
No, I think it's common for writers.
Yeah, but you've got to be in love with it or you can't write it.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't have that kind of delusional enthusiasm, there's not enough energy in it. But, you know, my process as a poet is probably similar to a fiction writer. You know, and a storyteller gets at truth in a different way than a, you know, someone who's speaking solely autobiographically.
Right.
And I worry when I, you know, even when I write prose, if I try to write an autobiographical prose, I just go on and on and on and on, and I can't tell what's important and what's not important. And I think that's probably why I had to objectify it a little bit, is to keep myself from running off at the mouth.
Before we get into the book, I need to give just one other tiny detail, which you kind of referred to earlier but didn't really talk about, and that is your unconventional narrative into poetry. Most poets, they go the MFA route. They, you know, they major in English, go the MFA route, and then they try to get a job at a university. That's not how you became a poet.
No, you know, I knew I wanted to be a poet by the time I was about 20. Mm-hmm. You know, I was an English major. I went to graduate school at Harvard in comp lit. And I was there a couple of years. I had great teachers. I had Elizabeth Bishop, Robert Fitzgerald, Northrop Frye, Octavio Paz was on the faculty,
wow.
Robert Lowell was on the faculty. It was a good place for a writer to be. But I realized, you know, they were training me to be a professor of literary theory.
Mm.
And I didn't want to write in a way that the people that I came from couldn't understand.
Right.
And, you know, I have to say a core belief, and you'll understand this, but a lot of people don't. Just because somebody's poor doesn't mean they're dumb.
Mm-hmm.
Just because someone doesn't have a lot of education doesn't mean that they aren't alert to the world and curious about it. And I've always felt that, you know, I wanted to be write a poem that could work across a lot of different sorts of people. Anyway, I decided to, you know, to quit, and I was the oldest person in a very poor and big family, mm-hmm. and I felt I needed to be practical. Because, you know, I'm going to have to help put my younger brother and sister, 20 and 21 years younger than me, through school. So
right.
I quit, and I went into business. And I'm the only person in human history who went to Stanford Business School to be a poet. And I, you know, and nobody ever got through Stanford doing less work than I did, because I was always in the library writing poems, writing reviews. And then I went off. I was in love with a girl and who I married. I've been married now 36 years.
Wow.
And she wanted to go to New York, and so I followed her there. We figured we'd stay there a couple of years. We got married, and we ended up being there for 20 years.
Wow.
And finally, I quit when I was 40, 41, because by that point, I was so well-known as a writer, I felt I could make a living. Plus, my first son had died suddenly.
Right.
And, you know, when you lose a kid, everything in life looks different.
Mm-hmm.
And I just said, you know, at that point, I put one of my brothers through college. I was able to help my folks. And I said, you know, if I'm going to do it, I just got to do it now. So, you know, just before my 41st birthday, I quit my job. They figured, you know, it was business. They figured I must have cancer or something.
Mm-hmm.
You don't just quit a job if you don't have another job.
And it was a good job. You were an executive at General Foods.
Yeah. I was, you know, I was, by that point, you know, I moved very slowly through the company, but I was the vice president of marketing, you know, for, you know, their most profitable division.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess maybe one of their two most profitable divisions. And, you know, and I just felt, just got to, you know, do it. And I had a couple of really tough years. I mean, you know, I had two kids.
Right.
You know, I waited till my wife and I had, you know, were able to have children again. She was pregnant with our younger boy when I quit. But, you know, things worked out well, and then we decided to move back to California because I wanted my kids to know they were from working people, they were from Latin people, they were from, you know, kind of working class Latin Catholics. And in New York, they were being raised in a kind of placeless, deracinated way. Mm-hmm. And I didn't like that. And so, you know, we moved down, and I came up to Northern California at that point to live near where my folks had moved. And it was good. It was good. You know, both my folks, who died, but my kids knew them, and they knew my kids. And, you know, we had some really good years.
Your mother, as you mentioned, was a telephone operator, Mexican-American, no advanced education. And apparently she used to read and recite poetry to you. What did she read to you?
Well, you know, she had just like the worst childhood because her mom died of cancer when she was five. Wow. And they were very poor. They didn't have enough to eat. But at that era in schooling, people made kids memorize poems. And these were very precious to her. Mm-hmm. And actually, both her and my grandfather, you know, liked poetry. So she would recite Edgar Allan Poe, Longfellow, James Whitcomb Riley, Eugene Field, a lot of poets that are not fashionable now, but she loved them, and they touched something inside of her. And so my earliest memory of poetry was my mother, you know, reciting, "It was many and many a year ago in a kingdom by the sea, the maiden there loved, whom you may know by the name of Annabel Lee." And these, you know, and the spell of that poetry was very powerful to me. Kipling, you know, she loved Whittier. You know, the great forgotten poet now, but he was the great poet of the abolitionist movement, you know, great, you know, poet about rural life. And so I grew up, you know, hearing, you know, people recite poems that they loved, you know, in a completely non-academic setting. And I've never, my foundation for poetry, which is that it's a pleasure of ordinary people. It's not an academic subject that you study in graduate school. And not everybody agrees with me, especially the critics who were in grad school, you know. So anyway, but, you know, you don't write to be popular with critics. You write to because the muse asks you to. Right. And you try to do the best job you can.
Well, that's a good segue into your new book. It's called 99 Poems, New and Selected. Is it weird for you to, at this point in your life, you're still young, you got many, many years to go, to have a new and selected volume?
I'm not so young. You know, I planned the book so it came out the year I turned 65.
Oh.
You know, so now
so you sound like you're 45.
Me, but, you know, I look on this as a late mid-career thing. Yeah. But, you know, what I did is I did something unusual in the book. I've never seen anybody else do something quite like this. I didn't do it chronologically because, you know, readers don't care about chronology. I took my poems, I cut about half of them out, and I arranged the ones I wanted to keep in seven categories.
Mm-hmm.
Mystery, by which I mean the mystery of existence, the mystery of being human. Mystery, place, remembrance, imagination, stories, songs, love. And, you know, and it was interesting for me to go through my work and decide what I thought was the best, you know, and I asked a couple of poets, you know, that I knew to, you know, make recommendations about what to keep and drop. Actually, one of them is a guy from, you know, from Texas who, you know, teaches in San Antonio, Chip Hughes, you know, and I made these things, and it makes you a little crazy, you know, to sink into your imagination for so long. But I was glad when the book got finished, and I, you know, I feel good about it. I feel it's a strong, you know, a very strong book that might explain to some people why I've dedicated my life to poetry rather than doing the more practical things I might have.
Oh, it's a fantastic book. My favorite sections, by the way, are mystery and stories. But I've been dipping into this book for the last 2 weeks and just have been, you know, really impressed by how accessible the poems are. And even the poems that are more formal, the sonnets and the vianelles, the forms don't even read like forms. Like one time I was reading a poem and halfway through I realized, oh, there's a rhyme scheme. How do you do that? How do you hide that there's a rhyme scheme?
Well, you know, I think poetry comes out of speech. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't you know come out of writing. You put it down in writing, and there's certain things you do that are for the page. But I try to make my poems sound as if someone somewhere could plausibly actually say this. You know, the rhymes should actually do that. They should sneak up on you.
Right.
And the rhythms sort of sneak up on you. But I'm glad you like the stories, because I do think that there's very few poets nowadays that really, you know, go after serious stories, you know. And, and the stories I have, I think, are about big subjects, about, you know, about crime, about death, about money, you know, about all these issues that people really face with, you know. And, you know, there's one of them, about half of which takes place in a jail of a guy who's murdered someone. And I've had people in my family that have been in jail, in one case, jail for murder. And I don't see people write about this. And, you know, I'm a serious literary poet, but it seems to me that if you're telling a story, you know, you really want to go into matters of life and death, really significant, you know, matters. And it's unusual. And I think, you know, also some people see a poem that's 10 pages long, they go, oh, man, I can't read that.
They're great stories, not only in terms of, you know, how the language is not complicated at all, but also in terms of you really know how to use the techniques of a fiction writer, you know, suspense and holding the information and then releasing it just at the right time. But you have this one line in one of the poem stories says, "Madness makes storytellers of us all," and all your characters in these stories are kind of a bit mad, aren't they?
Well, they're either mad or they're driven. You know, I mean, it's like this. I have this one poem called "Haunted," which is a ghost story.
Right.
Nobody would predict from the first half of that poem where it's and how it's going to end.
Right.
You know, and I think, and it's about a guy who is looking for something. And what he thinks he's looking for is money. What he thinks he's looking for is social status, money. But he discovers that's really not what he's looking for at the end.
Right.
You know, I think.
Well, even in that story, you have the neighbor lady showing the assessor the house of a dead woman.
Yeah.
And she says, "Now let me show you hell."
Yeah.
But we don't get to that image, which is the central image and real incredibly powerful image. I don't know if you want me to share it, but it's this image of this room full of just dolls that this old lady who was rich had eccentrically collected over the years out of garbage cans. And so there's headless dolls. There's some dolls that are, you know, clothed, some that aren't. There's some without arms. And it's just this whole image of a whole wall full of these dolls. But that line, "Let me show you hell," really makes us expect something, but what we get is even greater than what our imagination was able to come up with. And I thought that was a wonderful technique.
Well, I'm glad you like it. You know, that's a poem that I was a very central poem in my whole development as a writer. And it also, you know, it's like that poem, you know, I have this surface story going on. It's narrated by an accountant.
Mm-hmm.
But underneath it is, you know, is Dante's Divine Comedy, the Inferno, mm-hmm. the Purgatorio, and then a little vision of paradise at the end.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I've got something, and you don't need to know any of that to read the poem, but if you're a writer, you know, if you're another reader, there's a whole another dimension of the poem that sort of peeks in and things like this. And I like to write poems that are simple on the surface, but have a kind of resonance, you know, underneath. Once again, that's a fiction technique, you know, text and subtext. You know, playwrights worry about that. So I think songwriters do too. Fiction writers do. Poets don't tend to think of it very much.
Right. How did the character end up being a Chinese accountant? And why Chinese? How did that happen? Was it just following the language and it happened, or was it based on something, some experience
you
had had before?
Based on a couple. I mean, I'm from California, so that, you know, there's, you know, Anglos, Latinos, Asians, you know, and then African Americans. Those are the
right.
So I've always been raised around Asians, and mostly Chinese and Japanese. One of my brothers married a Korean girl, and it seemed to me that Asians are very much like Latins.
Uh-huh.
You know, they're totally family oriented. You know, they've got strong parental pressure and everything else. And so, Mr. Choi, you know, this Chinese American accountant, is a kind of, you know, he's an alternate version of me.
Mm, yeah.
It's probably what I would have been if I were Chinese American.
Right.
But once again, it allowed me to kind of create a character that wasn't me and take him through this story. And I actually saw this doll collection.
Mm.
Somebody said, they were saying, you know, they were driving in the country. They said, "I got to pull you over and show you this crazy woman, you know, who was then still alive, who collects things from trash." There's another poem in the book called Guide to the Other Gallery. It's about, you know, she had collections of bottles and keys. Mm-hmm. And then we go to this barn, and it was full of discarded dolls. You know, some of them have no legs, no arms. Some of them are naked. Some of them are filthy. Mm-hmm. And I walked in there, and it was, and I'm not kidding you, it was the scariest place I have ever been in my life. After about a minute or two, I said, I just got to get out of here. And I could never forget that, and I gradually had to... I tried to write about it as a description, didn't work, and I realized the only way I could make it work was to bring a character in it,
right,
so you could feel his reaction, and then slowly the poem grew. And then after the poem was about one-third done, my son died.
Oh, my God.
And I had to put the poem aside. I didn't write for almost a year.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I began to to finish the poem, the grief and the transformation that losing a child began to permeate the poem. I went back and rewrote a lot of the original sections. So it's a very complicated... I mean, the reader does not need to know any of that.
Right.
But I'm just telling you, since you asked, you know, this poem is it's central to my psychohistory and my whole development as a writer. I said, I have to finish this poem in a way which reflects what I've learned from this loss.
And there's a really beautiful, tender passage in the poem story where the man goes into his daughter's rooms and is watching them sleep, and then he notices their dolls lined on the shelf, and the look he gets from those dolls is just it must evoke that earlier image because it becomes very disturbing.
Yeah, well, it is. I mean, I couldn't end it with the vision of, you know, this kind of paradisial vision,
right?
Because, you know, we live in a fallen world. We live in a world where we suffer, we endure things, we have joy too. But you know, I didn't want to end on some kind of like happy, unqualified happy vision. I wanted to end back in the real world of mortal people.
Yeah.
So it's very highfalutin, but you know what I mean.
No, absolutely. I have a question about the having them read in such a way that even hard rhymes are lost in the reading. I think, you know, that's really an incredible technique to be able to do that. And I agree that it's about voices, but there's this one poem called All Souls. And you have this line that says, they want their voices to become the wind, intangible like them, to match its cry, howling in treetops, covering the moon, tumbling the storm clouds in a rain-swept sky. So you have wind, cry, moon, sky. But in the middle of the second line, you have intangible like them, which kind of evokes wind, even though it's in the middle of the line. And I'm wondering if it's a conscious choice to play with kind of rhyming words or similar words, even soft rhymes, in the middle of the line that de-emphasizes the end rhymes.
Yeah, well, the thing is that I was trained in music. You know, I played piano, saxophone, clarinet. And, when you learn, especially when you're playing jazz, you learn that phrasing is really powerful. Take a melody, but then the way you phrase the melody can make you hear the different things in the melody. So, you know, when I write a poem in form, even when I write a poem in free verse, I think of it as a musical composition. You create a kind of beat. Once you establish the beat, you never really let the listener know what's going to happen next.
Mm-hmm.
You play with the beat, you play with this. And so you know, I put in all kinds of sound effects into the poem. You know, I mean, I'll take a line. When I finish a poem, I do something very odd. I say, what's the worst line in the poem?
Huh.
And then I cross it out, and I have to figure out, do I want to just drop the line, which sometimes if you're in a rhyme scheme, means you have to drop other lines too, or do I revise it? And so I might come up with 50 variations of it until I get the line. And, you know, you can come up with all kinds of musical things, and I just keep saying the poem aloud until I feel like musically it works.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have internal rhymes. I have, assonance. You know, Spanish poetry works on assonance. They don't rhyme, the way that we do in English. And so, I grew up hearing, Spanish songs. And so, you have these, Americans would think of as half rhymes. You know, they rhyme the vowels, not the consonants. That's what you hear in Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a kind of a Spanish and Italian inflection, on this.
Yeah.
And I remember one of my first teachers just – 10 years later, he wrote me, and he says, you know, he said, now when I read this, I said, you know, what I realize is that I'm an Englishman, and you're a West Coast, you know, kind of Italian-Mexican, and you've brought the memory of the languages your family spoke into this poetry. And once you, you know, acknowledge that, you know, you go, yeah, this is a very different kind of music.
Hmm. We're unfortunately running out of time because I have at least 3/4 of the questions that I haven't been able to get to. But I do want to say before we ask you to read a poem that every time I enter a book of poems, I'm always impressed by a word that I've never heard of before. And I have to say the one that I was really impressed by this was from the stories. And the line is, she was a connoisseur of Schadenfreude. That word Schadenfreude is beautiful.
Great word. I mean, Schadenfreude is the, you know, which means shadow joy. And what it means is that the Germans came up with this word. It's the pleasure you feel when bad things happen to your friends.
Yes.
I mean, it's a very weird concept.
And it characterized the rich woman in this very well. It's a fantastic word.
Yeah. No, and it, unfortunately, it explains. This guy's in love with a girl, a woman who is not a good person. She's a beautiful, intelligent, rich, fun person, but she's not a good person. Well, before I do, I want to say just it's a pleasure to talk to an audience in El Paso, which is a city I've been to and I really love. I love the fact that the university there has a bilingual writing program. I love the museum. And there's an artist from El Paso, Tom Lee, who I just adore. I mean, if you know, especially this extraordinary painting of a woman, I believe it's his wife, that's in the El Paso Museum, which just makes me stop in my tracks and just
right.
Captivates me in the way that beauty should. But I know we're running out of time. Let me read a very short poem. This is a free verse poem, and it's about my son. You know, and when you lose a child, ever thereafter you'll see a kid who would be about the same age as your kid. You go, that's what my boy would be doing.
Wow.
That's what my son would look like. And I wrote this poem on what would have been my first son's 21st birthday, and it's called Majority, you know, in the sense of legal majority. Now you'd be 3, I said to myself, seeing a child born the same summer as you. Now you'd be 6 or 7 or 10. I watched you grow in foreign bodies, leaping into a pool, all laughter, or frowning over a keyboard, but mostly just standing, taller each time. How splendid your most mundane actions seemed in these joyful proxies. I often held back tears. Now you are 21. Finally, it makes sense that you have moved away into your own afterlife.
That was Dana Gioia. Dana, thank you so much for sharing your poems and for talking to us on Words on a Wire.
It's been a pleasure and a